Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Milton Osborne makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Tonight he's talking on the topic of Cambodia of four decades ago. Milton is the author of 10 books. He went to Cambodia as a young diplomat in the Australian Foreign Affairs Department from 1959 to 1961, and again in 1966, and he's been a regular visitor ever since. He was head of the Asia branch of the Office of National Assessments from 1982 to 1993. He's currently non-resident fellow of the Lowy Institute. He's received a gong from the French as the commander of the National Order of Merit in France for his contribution to the work on France in the Asia region. And tonight, Milton Osborne will be talking to us on why were the progressives so wrong about the Khmer Rouge, denying Khmer Rouge savagery. Malcolm Osborne, welcome.
Thank you very much, Gerard, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I should say at the start, I hate reading speeches, so that if I break off to extemporise, the text of the speech eventually will be available. In a period when anniversaries of major events are constantly remembered, Great War, Gallipoli campaign, bombing of Dresden, there's another anniversary falling next month on the 17th of April. And this is when the victorious Khmer Rouge marched into Phnom Penh and the bitter Cambodian civil war that had raged since 1970 came to an end. The war came to an end, but the savagery of the Khmer Rouge regime began. In the course of 3 years, 8 months and 20 days, somewhere between 1.75 and 2 million Cambodians died who otherwise would have lived. They died as the result of executions, an almost total lack of modern medical care, and terrible patterns of overwork in vast, poorly conceived agricultural cooperatives. We don't know the exact figure for the numbers executed, but a total of 200,000 or even 500,000 is not an impossible estimation. These extraordinary figures are justified by the evidence available from surveys of particular regions, where in some cases up to 66% of a given region's population was executed. The overall figures for loss of life between April 75 and January 79, which only the most purblind nowadays would dispute, mean that somewhere between 20 and 25% of Cambodia's 1975 population died. Now, I'm going to argue that there was ample early evidence of the awfulness that was taking place while the Pol Pot regime, or ANCAR as it was known, the organization, was in power. But it was not until after the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia, which began on Christmas Eve 1978 and effectively ended on the 7th of January 79, it was not until that invasion that we learnt of the existence of S-21, the tool-sling extermination centre located in the buildings of a former high school in Phnom Penh suburbs. Established around the middle of 1976, S-21 was a secret prison, and its existence was unknown to the rest of Cambodia's unfortunate population because almost no one who entered it emerged alive. To enter S-21 was to be presumed guilty, never mind that the institution had a motto over its door, "Fortify the Revolution." Because of the meticulous records kept by the jailers and torturers in S-21, we know that at least 14,000 persons were incarcerated, tortured until they confessed, to their crimes and then executed. After the grounds around S21 were too full of bodies, prisoners, after their confession, were taken to a location called Chung Ek, outside of Phnom Penh, where they were killed, being hit on the back of the head with an axle from an ox cart, and buried there. And that's the area, for those of you who've visited Phnom Penh, now known as the Killing Fields. Research by a French scholar, Henri Locard, suggests that there were other institutions like S21 in the rest of Cambodia, but it's still too soon to estimate the cost in lives in those other prisons. Now, the anniversary that falls due next month has been on my mind recently for a number of reasons. Partly because over the past year I've been writing what is a long letter to my daughter to try and tell her something about my life when either she hadn't been born or we weren't living together. Secondly, I was struck by Gerard Henderson's own reference to the public support given by senior members of the ALP in 1978 to the, quote, national liberation struggles in both Cambodia and Kampuchea, Vietnam and Kampuchea, and to Gough Whitlam's statement in the same year that he doubted, and again I quote, all the stories that appear in the newspapers about the treatment of people in Cambodia. I say struck because I was living outside of Australia from late 71 until early 1979, and I readily admit that my knowledge of Australian domestic politics in this period is very patchy. I had and have a deep personal interest in the events that followed the Khmer Rouge victory in 75 and its aftermath, and I have that interest for a number of reasons. I'm in no sense a disinterested commentator. In 1959, almost 16 years before Pol Pot and his associates came to power, I was posted, as Gerard mentioned, to the Australian Embassy in Phnom Penh. This was a posting that began when I was still 22 years of age that had a major effect and has had a major effect on my life. I found myself in a city and a country marked both by Cambodia's own exotic political culture and a remarkable overlay, at least at the elite level, of France in the Orient, an overlay stemming from some 90 years of France's colonial presence. By the time I had spent more than 2 years in Cambodia during my posting, I realised I wanted to know more about the country's history and more broadly of what had been France's colonies in that region, French Indochina. And this eventually led to my becoming a graduate student at Cornell, and in 1955 and 66, 65 and 66, to an extended period of dissertation research in Paris, Phnom Penh and Saigon. And after I had finished at Cornell in 1967, I continued to visit Cambodia each year, only ceasing after 1971 when travel outside of Phnom Penh became very difficult indeed. Both during my diplomatic posting and later as an overaged and underpaid graduate student, I had the good fortune to make a number of friends, good friends in Cambodia. What happened to some of those friends after April 75 is, I readily admit, fundamental to my feelings. I've written about the fate of some of these friends in my book Before Kampuchea, Preludes to Tragedy, which was published in 1979. So I'll be brief in speaking of them now. And there were other friends about whose fate I still know nothing. My closest friend, Prince Sisawat Panravong, is still alive for one good reason. He was living in Bangkok when the Khmer Rouge took power. But Panravong's father, Prince Sisawat Entravong, and his wife, Colonel Kim Kasal, and Monsignor Paulus Tepim Sota, all disappeared and were killed during the Khmer Rouge period. Sisawat Entravong, who had been an invaluable source of information about Cambodia's royal family when I was doing my research in 1966, he and his wife were driven out of Phnom Penh in the days immediately following the Khmer Rouge victory in that callous decision to empty the city, and somewhere south of Phnom Penh they fell by the wayside and were never seen again. They were just too of an estimated 10,000 people who died in the course of that cruel exodus. My friendship with Colonel Kim Casal began in 1959 when he was Captain Casal and continued when I returned in 66. And it was a friendship that even extended to his inviting me in that later year to spend a weekend on his army base on Cambodia's sensitive border with Vietnam. He was an apolitical soldier who could have left Phnom Penh before the Khmer Rouge victory if he'd wished, but he stayed because he believed it was his duty to do so. He was killed in the days immediately after the Pol Pot forces marched into Phnom Penh, probably beheaded along with other senior figures in the area, once occupied by the Sex Sportif, the French sporting club in Phnom Penh, the area, for those of you who have visited the Phnom Penh, where the embassy of the United States is now located. Monsignor Tepim, who had proven a wonderful intellectual companion when I met him in Phnom Penh in 1966, and who joked with me that he was a man of faith and I was a man without faith, was by 1971 apostolic vicar of Battambang, the region of Cambodia to the northwest. For reasons that are far from clear, he survived without being detained for about 10 days after the Khmer Rouge entered Battambang city. Yet even with the help of the Congregation of the Evangelization of the Peoples, the former Propaganda Fide of the Vatican, which I visited in 2008, I've not been able to add much to the information I recorded about his death in 1979. It's apparent that after finally being taken into custody by the Khmer Rouge and being told he would be allowed to leave Cambodia for Thailand, he was forced from the vehicle that was supposedly taking him to freedom and shot down close to the Thai-Cambodian border. Now, what I've just recorded are individual tragedies, and it's a fair comment that each of these friends were, in their different ways, members of Cambodia's elite. It's an equally fair comment that members of Cambodia's elite suffered disproportionately in terms of loss of life at the beginning of the Khmer Rouge domination of the country. Teachers and doctors became prime targets, and as has been often noted, even to wear a pair of spectacles was to be seen as an intellectual and so to be eliminated. But this does not mean that to be a peasant or low-level urban worker ensured survival. By the time Pol Pot's regime was overthrown, it was apparent that loss of life through executions extended across the whole of Cambodia's population. That this was so received clear confirmation when I acted as a consultant for UNHCR in 1980 and 1981, working in camps, refugee camps, along the Thai-Cambodian border. Starting in mid-1979 and accelerating through the final months of that year, tens of thousands of Cambodians flooded into Thailand. They were seeking refuge from the chaotic conditions that developed after the Vietnamese invasion and the defeat of the Khmer Rouge. By the end of 1979, some 90,000 Cambodian refugees were housed in the largest of these camps, Khao Edang. But there were smaller camps with still other numbers in the other camps, to a total of some 175,000 refugees. And that doesn't take into account people in the so-called border agglomerations just inside Cambodia's border. This situation posed an enormous problem for UNHCR that had to administer the camps and seek a way to find a future for those within them. And they turned to me because of my knowledge of Cambodia to see if I could find something of the background to the attitudes held by the refugees towards the future, their future, and whether or not they might at some stage return to Cambodia. I did so through the means of an in-depth survey of 100 refugees in Khao Edang and seven other camps over a period of some 2 months. In a sample that I endeavoured to have approximate the social structure that existed in Cambodia before 1970. That is, the survey was heavily weighted to reflect the preponderance of peasant farmers and fishermen and unskilled urban workers, to a total of some 59 people, with the remaining numbers made up of people associated with business, the civil service, armed services, and students. Now, the full details of this survey are available in printed form, and they're too detailed to go into now. But in relation to the vexed issue of which group of Cambodians suffered under Pol Pot, was it only, as some people suggested, the bourgeoisie? Well, my findings are clear. If the bourgeoisie were the main target initially, the cost in lives across the whole of Cambodia's population was staggering. Of the 100 refugees I interviewed in depth, no fewer than 40 had lost close, that is to say nuclear family members, through executions, to a total of 88 persons. Of these persons, 27 were drawn from farmer fishermen or low-level worker occupational backgrounds. Now, what I've outlined now is what we know today and came to know rapidly after 1979. But matters were very different in the period immediately after the Khmer Rouge victory. The key events at that time were the forced exodus of Cambodia's population in the capital, and that was seen by the journalists who were still in Phnom Penh at that time, and the seclusion of all foreigners in the country some few days after the victory of the Khmer Rouge, the total seclusion of all foreigners in the French embassy compound in Phnom Penh, from which they eventually were taken out of Cambodia at the end of April 1975. This meant that from that time on, and with the exception of a few foreign women married to Cambodians, there were no foreign resident observers of developments within Cambodia for the next 3 years. I stress resident because in the later period of Khmer Rouge rule, selected friendly parties of foreigners were brought into the country for carefully controlled visits. Now, for those who'd opposed the Vietnam War, whether in the United States, Australia, or elsewhere, the Khmer Rouge victory was a cause for praise. For to use William Shawcross' memorable phrase, Cambodia was a sideshow to Vietnam. Therefore, if you opposed American involvement in Vietnam, it was almost automatically the case that you opposed America's involvement in Cambodia. And that brought the next step, which was approval for the new regime in Phnom Penh, about which people knew very little. Now, I took a different view. Critical though I was of much that took place in both Vietnam and Cambodia, I never became an advocate for the Vietnamese or the Cambodian communists. Not only was I aware of the brutality of the North Vietnamese regime in the post-Geneva Accords period after 1954 in the northern half of the country, and then in the later hostilities that took place in both Vietnam and Cambodia, I had friends and acquaintances in both countries. Indeed, in 1969 and 70-71, I was the house guest of a senior Vietnamese politician in Saigon for several weeks on two occasions. And being critical of aspects of the Vietnam War and events in Cambodia did not mean that I was other than grateful for the assistance I received, both officially and unofficially, from the Australian Army in Vietnam, particularly the Australian Army training team. In the months after the Khmer Rouge victory in Cambodia, April 75, and then shortly after of the communists in Vietnam, I became deeply concerned to have news of what was happening in those countries. Watching events from outside Australia, I became increasingly concerned as information began to circulate about developments in Cambodia. Central to my concern was the first major article to attempt a detailed account of what life was like in Cambodia, written by Henry Kam of the New York Times and published on the 15th of July 1975. At that time, I'd not met Henry. I met him later in 1980 when I was working as a consultant to UNHCR, and I'm happy to say that we remain very good friends, and I look forward to seeing him in Provence next month. Kam's front page article runs to more than 60 column inches and is headed, Cambodian refugees tell of revolutionary upheaval. People who fled recently report wide terror emptied towns, and forced labour of millions clearing jungles. It seems almost redundant now to quote in detail from what Cam wrote, because it's now become so widely known. Disruption of life, friends and relatives carried away by those in authority never to return, towns deserted, arbitrary killings, and harsh labour conditions. The supporters of the Khmer Rouge victory, reports such as Cam's and others that followed, were not trusted. Indeed, distrust of refugee accounts became a leitmotif of those such as Laura Summers, an American academic then living in Britain, who wrote in favour of the new regime in Phnom Penh. The numbers of refugees who'd made their way into Thailand by the second half of 1975 was in the thousands. In fact, when Cam wrote his article, it was already 6,000 refugees. But this was not considered as sufficient to give a representative picture of life inside the country. When Laura Summers wrote in the Current History magazine issue of December 75, thus far, few Khmers have left the country, and many of these are former officers from Lon Nol's army or former civil servants who fear prosecution for wartime activities. No war crime tribunals have been mounted, probably because the Royal Government of National Unity wants to avoid deepening internal socio-political conflicts and bitterness at a time of reconstruction. Now, it's worth noting that Summers' article took no notice of the fact that Cam's informants were mostly peasants or low-level workers or ordinary soldiers rather than officers. The assertion that there were no war crime trials betrays a fantasy expectation, as does the suggestion that the Royal National Government of National Unity was actually still in existence. By early 1976, there were other reports circulating of the brutality taking place. In February, for instance, I didn't know this at the time, François Ponchot, who was later well known for his book Cambodge Année Zéro, Cambodia Year Zero, was the author of a number of articles in Le Monde in February 76, recounting his own experience and drawing on interviews he had been in Phnom Penh in 75 and drawing on interviews he'd conducted with refugees. These interviews endorsed the picture already reported by Cam. Yet the academic community, or at least parts of it, either remained silent or wrote like Laura Summers in praise of the supposed virtues of the new regime. For any interested visitor, and I was one such, to Bangkok, it was easy to gain access to well-informed commentators, both Cambodian and foreign, who had horrendous accounts of what was taking place. And it was at this stage that I was asked by a Japanese journal, Pacific Community, to contribute an article on developments in Cambodia. I wrote it by the middle of 76, and it was published in October. And I'll try and be brief as I read from my own prose. No foreigner yet knows the full truth about developments in Cambodia, nor probably do many Cambodians. But the full truth is an elusive concept at the best of times, even under ideal conditions, which are clearly not the circumstances in Cambodia during the second year following the defeat of Lon Nol's forces. Segments only of the overall picture are revealed with any clarity, but viewed discreetly or taken as an incomplete assemblage, these segments suggest a revolution of staggering proportions imposed harshly upon an already war-ravaged country. They suggest a resort to brutal methods that can only be explained by some deep and perhaps desperate fear that the revolution might be halted or even turned around. And they suggest that policy measures that might in the abstract be regarded as rational and desirable have been pursued in that terrible vacuum of unreality where the end justifies the means. I concluded the article by saying throughout this article there is the need to recognise the inadequacies of our information. Few comments can be made with unqualified certainty, and there's a faint possibility that in some areas of the country the general picture of conditions is less dark than is widely taken to be the case. But if this is not the case, then to remain silent in the face of developments in Cambodia is for those who in the past have claimed to be knowledgeable about the country represent a contemporary treason of the Clarks. But the treason only continued, and to my great regret, some of the most egregious support came from people, in addition to Laura Summers, who were associated with the Cornell Southeast Asia program. Probably the most notable of the willful disregard for reality was a short book written by Gareth Porter and George Hildebrand, with an approving introduction from George Kahan, the director of the Southeast Asia program. The book was called Cambodia, Starvation and Revolution, and the aim of the book was to explain why the population was forced out of Phnom Penh, and it was supposedly based on suppressed documents and the regime's official bulletins. I quote just a little from it. A careful examination of the facts regarding the evacuation shows that the description and interpretation of the move conveyed to the American public was an inexcusable distortion of reality. What was portrayed as a destructive, backward-looking policy motivated by hatred was actually a rationally conceived strategy for dealing with urgent problems. Porter and Hildebrand, writing in 76, discounted the observation by those who'd observed the exodus. New York Times correspondent Sidney Schoenberg, Father Ponchot. Now compare what they wrote with what François Ponchot wrote as an observer on the exodus. It was, he said, a hallucinatory spectacle. Thousands of wounded and sick were leaving the city, the less seriously ill painfully dragging themselves along. Others were carried by friends, while others still were being pushed along on their hospital beds by their families, with their plaza and IV drips bumping alongside. I shall never forget, he wrote, one cripple who had neither hands nor feet, writhing along the ground like a cut worm, or the man with his foot dangling at the end of a leg to which it was attached by nothing more than skin. But aware or not of Ponchot's early writings, there were repeated refugee references available to those who had been sceptical. But over and again, those who wrote in favour of the Pol Pot regime dismissed such evidence. In this regard, I could go on citing Ben Kiernan in Australia, Malcolm Caldwell in Britain, Jean Lacouture in France, and of course Wilfrid Burchett, and many others who continued through 1976 and 1977 into 78 to present a picture of events in Cambodia that bore no relation to reality. And then there was Noam Chomsky. There's a thesis to be written about Noam Chomsky and the modern history of Cambodia. His scepticism about the toll of Pol Pot's murderous policies was cloaked in highlighting errors in reports and writing on events in Cambodia, and by an insistent claim that what was happening in Cambodia was the result of American policies, and in particular the American covert bombing campaign, which ended in 1973, Operation Menu. I am at one with William Shawcross, who commented on Chomsky in June 1981 when he wrote, "Chomsky's position on Cambodia has been disastrous ever since the Khmer Rouge victory in 1975. By continually concentrating on mistakes which journalists and writers have made and on the way in which Western governments have exploited stories out of Cambodia, he has deflected attention from the far more important issue, whether or not gross abuses of human rights were committed there in Cambodia." Yet there is still the question of why so many commentators, particularly those with a claim to academic values, got it wrong. Leaving Chomsky aside, some of the most prominent supporters of the Khmer Rouge regime have acknowledged they were wrong and tried to explain their position. Ben Kiernan, for instance, writing in 1979, said, "I was wrong. The brutal authoritarian trend within the revolutionary movement was not simply a grassroots reaction, an expression of popular outrage at the killing and destruction in the countryside by US bombs. There can be no doubt that the evidence points clearly to a systematic use of violence against the population." He was attracted, he said, before coming to this conclusion, by what he claimed to see as the humanitarian socialist ideals of the Khmer Rouge. Gareth Porter was to say in 2010 in relation to his writings on the Khmer Rouge, "I've been well aware for many years that I was guilty of intellectual arrogance. I was right about the bloodbath in Vietnam." He proposed that there was not a bloodbath. I'd query that after 1954. "But I was right," he said, "so I assumed I'd be right about Cambodia." Another view was heard in Australia as late as 1980, when Gavin McCormick, then at the ANU, continued to argue that the truth about the Cambodian revolution is extraordinarily difficult to discover. Till sometime in 1978, the case against Kampuchea was of such a dubious nature that many socialists and progressive people refused to give it any credence. It is likely some fabrication or distortion of evidence was still going on. But in my view, the balance of probability has now shifted heavily towards the view that the Cambodian revolution between 1975 and the end of 1978 was a terrible travesty. At least one of his fellow leftist academics was ready to say to me a year earlier, when I returned to Australia in 1979, in what I took to be an acceptance of the awfulness of what had occurred in Cambodia, "But why didn't you tell us what's happening, comrade?" I don't subscribe to the rubric that to understand all is to forgive all, but if one is seeking to explain how so many observers fail to approach Cambodia with an open mind, it has to be in terms of their mindsets, whether as idealists or as older, committed believers in a vision of socialism that was automatically anti-American in form. The most dispiriting thing for me, distressing indeed, is that George Kahan, director of the Cornell Southeast Asia Program, a charismatic teacher and a member of my PhD committee when I was a graduate student, should have strayed so far from the academic standards that I believed he held. In writing his approving introduction to Porter and Hildebrand's book, he was abandoning the standards that I believed he had expected of his students. For he wrote his approving introduction with no regard for the contrary factual evidence readily available that was in opposition to his position. Whether in the case of Summers, Kahan, Porter, Hildebrand, Kernan or others, including the left-wing press in France, epitomised by the newspaper Libération, the readiness to discount refugee accounts of what was happening in Cambodia in favour of a confected vision of some form of revolutionary utopia reflected at best unthinking fantasy and at worst unqualified intellectual arrogance. As with Simon Sharma's observation about another revolution and people who have written about it, these people either were or risked being guilty of intellectual cowardice and moral self-delusion. In doing so, to quote Sharma again, they contributed to the scholarly normalization of evil.
Many thanks. So many thanks to Milton Osman. We'll come to questions and discussion. I should point out that in last Friday's edition of Media Watchdog, which goes up on the Institute blog every Friday after lunch, we ran the full text of Dr. Osborne's 1976 paper from Pacific Community. So it's there if you want to access it. It's on the blog as a link. Last Friday went up, and there it remains. So we come to question discussion. Thanks for a fine presentation. As I recall, Jonathan Mirsky, who'd written misleading stuff about Mao's China, as you'd be aware, the American, still writing these days as a journalist, then as an academic. As I recall, when he reflected on why he got the brutality of Mao's China so wrong, he said something like, "We believe because we wanted to believe. We were wrong because, in a sense, we wanted to be wrong." Do you think that's a reasonable explanation for the people you're discussing here, or do you think naivety comes into account? Why do you think they were so wrong?
I think it's a combination both of people not wanting to believe because it contradicted their vision of what they thought ought to be happening. And I think it also involved naivete, plus an abandonment, as I said, of academic standards. Neither Gareth Porter nor George Hildebrand had ever been to Cambodia. Laura Summers, who I quoted, had made one brief visit. George Kayan, who was a man, he's no longer alive, whom I greatly admired, had reached the point of being so opposed to the Vietnam War that when it came to Cambodia, I don't think he heard what he didn't want to hear. And one should also put the period in the context of the late 1960s, early 1970s, or into the 70s. The academic 1968 manifestation in Paris. It was all part of a period where anti-Americanism, anti-Vietnam War involvement, a belief that somehow the regime in Phnom Penh was illegitimate because it had thrown out that darling of the left, Sihanouk. These all came together. In the case of the French in particular, the fact that the fact that Sihanouk had been thrown out of power in 1970 and then associated himself with those who were to become the leaders of the Khmer Rouge regime undoubtedly played a part in the unreadiness of people to face up to facts. Jean Lacouture, whose name I mentioned very briefly, had at one stage been a strong advocate for the virtues of the Khmer Rouge. After he read François Poncheux's book, he did a complete turnabout and wrote a book called, in French, I don't believe it was ever translated into English. The book was called Survive le peuple cambodgien, Survive People of Cambodia, in which he acknowledged that he had been wrong and tried to give a more accurate picture of what was happening.
Right, so we go to... yes, Mon, you stay here and talk down the back. Yeah.
Taking that the reverse, to what extent did the barbaric nature and the truth coming out about Cambodia have an effect on the re-evaluation of communism in Southeast Asia for the media and for the intellectuals? Did it have any effect? In other words, in changing that kind of blinkered approach to what had actually happened in the whole condition?
Well, it certainly endorsed the views of people like the late Lee Kuan Yew, that all of his views about communism were absolutely endorsed by the awfulness of what had taken place in Cambodia. It certainly was ultimately regarded as beyond the pale by the Vietnamese, who invaded Cambodia at the end of 1978 and early 79 for reasons other than the liberation of the Cambodian people, because the crazy Pol Pot regime had been mounting attacks across the border into Vietnam. I think it was an endorsement that was seen widely throughout Asia as a whole, but particularly in Southeast Asia, that extreme communism was not a path ever to be followed.
And there's a question here, yes?
Dr. Osborne, the determination to see Western intervention as the source of all evil in societies is somewhat mirrored today in the interpretation of Middle Eastern developments. For example, Islamic sectarianism, as the violence of it, is seen as the product of, again, of Western intervention in the Middle East. Do you think that people become so entrenched in their paradigm that it's impossible to give up?
So the question is whether the concept of Western intervention was raised as an excuse in Indochina, but also today in parts with respect to parts of the Middle East.
I'm not qualified to talk about the Middle East. I think that you would need to look at various periods to see how people thought about the issue of Western intervention. I mean, it was not the case, for instance, that there was immediately a tide of anti-American feeling when the Americans became involved in Vietnam. That came later. it was seen as quite a reasonable thing that people should support the government of South Vietnam in the period 63-64. As the war dragged on, as there were incidents like My Lai, as people became aware of massive bombing campaigns, not the least to the fact that the way in which the war was being waged was not particularly successful and involved a lot of civilian casualties, all of these helped to change things. But I don't want to sound as though my whole presentation is an apologia pro vita mea, but I could never see that because you opposed some aspects of what was happening in Vietnam or in Cambodia, that that meant you automatically thought there was right only on the other side.
Question, don't stand in front of the camera, yes? Yep.
Yes. The invasion by the Vietnamese on Cambodia, we remember that there was a sort of Western boycott of the Vietnamese at that time. Malcolm Fraser, almost, I think, an alliance of Chinese, but I may have that wrong. Is there anything good to be said about that period of time in Cambodia when the Vietnamese were in control?
So there's a question about the West's reaction to the invasion of Cambodia by Vietnam.
To say the very least, and I've written this in a book I most recently published on Phnom Penh, the book is called Phnom Penh, a Cultural and Literary History, and I address that period and say it was an extraordinarily ambiguous period. On the one hand, there was recognition that the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia rid Cambodia of the Khmer Rouge, and that was a good thing. At the same time, it raised questions of international law about the right of one country to invade another. There is no clear, in my mind, no clear, easy way in which to say right was here on one side and not on the other. But you're right in referring, of course, to the fact that there was an informal but important coalition between the most unlikely partners in relation to Cambodia, between the United States and China, in terms of supporting those who would try to overthrow the regime established by the Vietnamese in Phnom Penh, the protege regime established by the Vietnamese. And it wasn't until the end of the 1980s that things began to be clarified, that ambiguity began to be dissolved, and a recognition was reached that from all parties' point of view, Cambodia without a Vietnamese presence was the best choice for that country's future.
There's a question here. Yes.
Dr. Osborne, not quite part of your theme, but is there any indication as to what the Khmer Rouge thought they were going to get out of this sort of campaign? What were they trying to achieve?
So the question is, what were the Khmer Rouge trying to achieve in their own minds?
Yep.
Yeah, I do.
There is, I think, a partial answer. There is a partial answer, and it takes you back to Paris in the early 1950s, when a group of young Cambodian students, of whom Salot Sar, which was his birth name, Pol Pot's birth name, and Khieu Samphan, and others who ended up as the leading figures in the Khmer Rouge regime, were all students together in Paris, and they met in what they called a Marxist circle, and they discussed what they saw as the future of Cambodia. The evidence is not absolutely clear, but it seems pretty certain that at that period, Pol Pot had decided that on the basis of his reading, the revolutions that had taken place elsewhere, including particularly the French Revolution, had not been sufficiently revolutionary, that what had to be achieved was a total reordering of society. And if that meant the loss of life, if that meant stripping the country of cities, These were all things that had to happen. Of course, there's a great deal of hypocrisy that also needs to be noted in this. While the bulk of the Cambodian population was living in indescribably awful conditions, Pol Pot and his senior associates lived in great comfort in Phnom Penh. One of my, not close friends, but a friendly acquaintance that I had known over the time I was in Cambodia through the 60s, and whom I met in a refugee camp. It was an extraordinary experience to suddenly hear my name called out as I walked through Khao Edang. Had been summoned back from working in the rice fields to work as an engineer in Phnom Penh when the number of people in Phnom Penh was probably no more than 50 or 60,000 instead of 2 million. And he was there because as an engineer, he could keep the place working and the air conditioning running for people like Pol Pot and his associates.
Question down the back, Paul. Yes.
Dr. Osborne, can you remind us where did Seamuth go when he left the country and what harbored him and what was the end of him?
So the question is after the overthrow of Sihanouk, where did he go and where did he end up?
Well, he ended up in Beijing and he spent the period from 1970 to the Khmer Rouge victory either in Beijing or in Pyongyang, where he was a good friend of Kim Il-sung, an unlikely combination. After the Khmer Rouge victory, he was not allowed to return initially to Cambodia by the Khmer Rouge, but they sent him off on a speaking tour around the world to friendly countries, essentially socialist countries in Eastern Europe. Then he eventually was allowed to return in December of 1975 and after a short period placed under house arrest by the Khmer Rouge, where he remained until the regime was overthrown. He was transported to Beijing and then sent to talk in the United Nations, at which stage he decided that his future was better placed away from the Khmer Rouge handlers who were looking after him, and initially with the assistance of the United States.
So the end for him?
The end for him was that he returned eventually in... He played a fluctuating role in the discussions that took place during the 80s to try and find a peaceful solution for Cambodia. And when the United Nations established the UNTAC, the United Nations... Transitional Authority for Cambodia, which brought an end to the conflict, Sihanouk returned, and in October, I think, of 1993, he was reinstated as king of Cambodia before he abdicated in 2004.
There's a question right down the back, then over there. Yeah, down here. Don't stand in front of the camera. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Dr. Osborne, I was wondering where he... That was, I'll give your opinion, in the mid-1970s, who were the good guys and the bad guys?
Right, in the mid-1970s, in your opinion, who were the good guys, who were the bad guys?
Well, there were very few good guys that I could see on the Khmer Rouge side. No, it's important to recognise that the situation... towards the end of the 1960s in Cambodia was one in which there was a great deal of dissatisfaction with Sihanouk's regime at levels on both the right and the left of Cambodian politics. And there was great resentment of what was seen as corruption on the part of people closely associated with Sihanouk's consort, Princess Monique. This meant that members of elite families on occasion went out to join the revolutionary forces. Whether they had a clear idea of what they were getting involved in, I think is very uncertain. The regime that was in power in Phnom Penh between 1970 and 1975 had a range of people within it, some good, some bad. Some were genuinely there with the hope that they could find a better way of administering Cambodia. Others were corrupt and not particularly admirable figures. One would also have to say that brutality on the battlefield took place both on the part of the Khmer Rouge and on the part of the government forces from the Phnom Penh government. But nothing really prepared anyone for what took place after 1975.
There's a question around the corner there. Yes.
Yes, Dr. Osborne,
what underpinned Pol Pot's rise to power?
He was a dedicated worker for the revolution. He came back to Phnom Penh from France, where he didn't gain any sort of qualification. He was not even studying for a degree. He was studying as an electrician, basically. He came back to Phnom Penh, and he taught as a private school teacher. He was highly regarded by his students. He had a knowledge and apparently a love of French poetry. Everyone who's ever met him spoke of him as a man who had a charismatic personality. But in 63, he was on a list that Sihanouk security forces prepared of people who were regarded as dangerous leftists, and he, like a number of others, fled into the countryside. And he spent the next 7 years before the overthrow of Sihanouk living in very harsh conditions in association with Vietnamese communists. And during that period, he rose steadily through the ranks of the revolutionary organization until he became the general secretary of the clandestine Cambodian Communist Party.
There's a question here, and then here and here. Yes?
I'm just wondering about Africa, where we see, for example, a mentality, hatred of colonialism in the likes of Robert Mugabe. Was there any of that kind of mentality in Cambodia, or hatred of the French as the colonial overlords, that fueled any of this conflict?
No. The impact of the French in Cambodia was remarkably small. One can certainly cite instances of resistance against tax imposed during the colonial regime, but it was remarkable the extent to which, particularly at the elite level, and that was where the interaction took place between the French and Cambodians, it was remarkably amicable. So it wasn't basically an anti-colonial movement, although to some extent the Khmer Rouge, before they gained power, did try to, what they believed was the case of exploitation by a regime that had linked itself to the colonial past. But nothing like Mugabe. Okay. Nothing at all.
Second last question.
Now 4 decades on, Cambodia is still struggling. And you know much about it. How would you sum up the loss? Not just the loss of a generation, the loss of infrastructure, the loss of things, but the loss of cultural memory. What's left and how will it be put back in any way?
I am amazed at the extent to which cultural memory is being recovered. Indeed, if I had the opportunity to write a second edition to my book about Phnom Penh, I would be much more positive today than I was when I wrote that book in 2007. There has been a tremendous recapturing of cultural knowledge, the promotion of traditional ways of dancing and of and also movements that develop out of traditional cultural activities, modernized movements without rejecting the past, a much deeper appreciation, I think, now than ever before of the importance of the Angkorian past, the great period between the 9th and the 15th centuries, much more than used to be the case. So although there is much that I'm critical of and people ought to be critical of in relation to contemporary Cambodia, it is a corrupt, to use the term in the last week's Economist, a corrupt thugocracy. But it is so much better than it was. And I think it is getting better in a significant fashion, really with each passing month.
Final question about the Australian journalist, Wilfred Burchett, who you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I was at a function in Melbourne late last year, and he was voted into the Media Hall of Fame. Now, in fairness to the organisers, they said it was for his reporting out of Japan in 1945, but nobody mentioned that he supported virtually every communist regime in Western Europe and in Eastern Europe and Africa that killed journalists, among others. Just tell us a bit more about his relationship with the Khmer Rouge regime.
I met Wilfred Burchett on a number of occasions in Cambodia, and actually once, I think only once, in Paris. He was a dedicated propagandist for left-wing causes, and now it seems without doubt a secret member of the Australian Communist Party. His role in Cambodia before the Khmer Rouge took over was very much as a person who was a spokesman for the left, who, given the opportunity to speak to visiting foreign journalists, would spin a story that was in favour of the Vietnamese communists. For instance, he would say, it's absolute nonsense that there are Vietnamese communist forces seeking sanctuary in side Cambodia, when he, as well as anyone else, undoubtedly knew that was wrong. He welcomed the arrival of the Khmer Rouge, and then slowly it became clear to him, after about 2 years, that perhaps all was not what he had hoped it would be. And he did a switch, which was to support the propaganda that was coming out of Vietnam, which said the events taking place within Cambodia were dire. The Vietnamese had remained silent for the better part of 2 years, but once they began to draw attention to what was happening in Cambodia, Wilfred changed position, particularly as he'd become concerned that perhaps all was not well in his relationship with the Chinese.
Many thanks, Milton Osborne. Many thanks for a wonderful presentation tonight. Dr. Osborne commenced his talk by saying we're coming up to the 40th anniversary of the Khmer Rouge victory in April 1975, and what's important is that within a year of that victory, Milton Osborne was warning
you
about
have been
the consequences
to the Sydney
so
Institute
many academics,
podcast.
This podcast is proudly brought politicians to you through the support the of Microsoft. So it was quite a courageous position to take
we
then.
We hope you enjoyed
and in a way, it's still a courageous
can join
position
us again
to take
soon.
Today because a lot of people don't like recognising, like Noam Chomsky, for example, that they got it so dreadfully, dreadfully wrong. So we're delighted to have you here today for this important presentation. It'd be great to, when Anne publishes it in the Sydney Papers Online, it's on our podcast, Channel 648's here tonight as well. So well done for tonight. We'll have you back sometime in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Derek.